Hello and welcome to Bacan, an English language podcast about my Spanish language adventure in Chile. Close your eyes for a moment. No, really, do it. When I say the word Patagonia, what do you see? If you're an exchange student studying in Chile, it's a question of when, not if, you're going to visit Patagonia. For weeks, my peers have been exhausting themselves trying to take advantage of the last few weeks of manageable weather before the national park closes. But if you're the average Chilean, Patagonia likely evokes a certain longing. Most nationals, a whopping 70%, have never visited. Maybe if you're of a certain demographic, you think of the Cali-based outdoor gear company that has recently took on the environmental fight against Donald Trump. If you're a foodie, the word might call to mind the episode of Chef's Table on Netflix about Francis Malman, the Argentine celebrity chef.
I think there are two places. One is Patagonia and the other one is Paris. Patagonia is home. It's, you know, the language of the mountains, of the clouds, of the forests. And Paris is sort of a lover I have that I like so very much.
Malman represents the quintessential chic, wealthy Argentinian. He speaks several languages and shuffles between accents easily. Wizened and gray, he sits on a boat in one dramatic scene, and a fisherman, trudging through the shallow bay, brings him a wooden tray of meats and vegetables. His blue eyes, his surname, all ooze of European romance. Large portions of the episode are devoted to his time in France and his obsession with French culture, which is absolutely fascinating, but also absolutely typical. And he owns a remote island in Patagonia called Lago La Plata, where he encounters constant inspiration for his award-winning, world-renowned menus. And that brings me to this point. Patagonia is more than just the most southernmost region of South America. It's a symbol of wealth and privilege, a shining example of ecotourism, an isolated collection of mountains and plains shared by Chile and Argentina. This episode is about Patagonia, but it's also about what this space represents, about symbols, the Andes, intercontinental division, the myths and memories of colonialism, and more.
Can't miss spot because my mom had been watching a show called Chef's Table, which is called Chef's Table on Netflix, and there was this
I love Chef Table. I'm gonna talk about Chef's Table at the beginning of this episode, which is such
an amazing show. Didn't even know that India had already seen it, but there is this incredible chef. I wish I could recall his name, but he owns restaurants in Miami, in New York, in Italy, in France, and like all these amazing places, but he's originally from Patagonia. And
This is my beautiful friend Maddie Fisher, student of Spanish, Portuguese, and Global Studies from Minnesota. Recently, her parents and aunt came to visit for a long and lovely 2 weeks, during which they traveled up and down the country, from the northern Atacama Desert to the Torres del Paine National Park in Patagonia. Maddie got to tag along for the latter.
But yeah, so the hotel we were staying at was on private property, which I found completely bizarre because I was under the impression that Torres del Paine, the national park that's really well known in Patagonia, was completely nationalized, that it was something that was being paid for by taxes and different things like that, and you have to pay to enter the park, you have to pay to camp.
Sure.
But I was told a lot of the history of that area about back in the day, they really wanted people to settle down there, so they gave a lot of Croatian and German and other European immigrants land. And up until now, a lot of it is still owned by those families. And the park itself, obviously, is gorgeous, and the surrounding areas likewise. But that was an interesting conflict I never envisioned for that part of the world, because it just seemed so bizarre to have something so beautiful and precious and special to Chilean culture and like Chilean identity be owned by people who now are considered Chilean, but prior were quite foreign.
sure. So,
and I think for me too, especially once I got here, everyone was just like, Torres del Paine is amazing, and Patagonia, like, it's just a can't miss spot. If you can make it happen, like, make it happen now, because about like this week, pretty much a lot of the park is going to be closed because the park ranger's offices are closed, so you can't do check-ins. Mm-hmm. And with the snow, it just becomes pretty inaccessible. And we were able to do, my dad and I did the Base de los Torres, which is like a 22-kilometer, essentially completely uphill hike to see the Torres del Paine, which are like a really iconic spot in the park. And I mean, we would never have been able to do that because like my parents are huge supporters of national parks, but like they're really just getting into the point of their life where they have a lot of time to do traveling.
Sure.
We've been traveling for a long time, but they're taking really big trips now. And so we were able to do that with the help of a guide. And I think that that was just an experience that like my dad will never forget. Like he was so emotional about it because it was something that like we were able to share together. And seeing a glacier like was definitely like a dream of my mom's for a really long time. And just like, I mean, it doesn't seem like we went. Like, it was so unreal. Like, the experience in itself, like, besides where we were staying, which was an incredible experience in itself, you just wake up and there's, like, mountains everywhere. The lakes are just, you can drink water from a glass from the lake. I mean, types of trees that you'll never see anywhere else and, like, wildlife that is continuing to sustain itself off of the ecosystems that have been there for hundreds and hundreds of years, which... coming from, like, Minnesota, like, completely flat farmland, like, we have to control our deer population was just a totally different, like, way of life that was really, really impressive and exciting to see. I think it, like, kind of gave me hope that, like, even though they were telling us about the ozone, like, there's, like, a hole in our ozone which causes, like, the sun to be really strong down there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're still really passionate about, like, recycling and, like, taking... ecologically friendly steps like in everything that they do, which I thought was like something I hadn't anticipated just because it is a hotel. I didn't know like what their stance would be on that, but from what I got from the other hotels that we visited as well on our different tours and things like that, like everybody took it really seriously and like the grounds were kept amazing and the park, like I didn't see any trash. I think the whole experience was, like, much more profound than I was, like, anticipating. Like, seriously, it's, like, the so many different types of terrain in one. Like, it just really humbles you.
Well, you're kind of well-situated to answer this question. Was the general tourism culture different than what you've experienced in Valpo and Viña? And was it excessively expensive, excessively Americanized in comparison? What do you think?
I would say... having been in Chile for 2-ish months prior to my parents coming, I really wasn't exposed to how Americanized tourism is here because I was really pushing myself to always speak Spanish first. Even when I was doing tours or seeing people around the city and things like that. But I mean, the second we got to any place and I was with my parents, like I would say that's including airports, El Calafate for sure, Patagonia Camp, hands down. I mean, no one can work there without a really high level of English. And all of the guides, like, knew very, specific vocabulary, but it was such a unique experience because I was able to help them have more profound conversations because I was able to translate, or they were able to say things to me and I could kind of go further or explain to my parents. But I would definitely say that, like, the tourism is quite Americanized. I think it is extremely expensive. And you can't just show up with one jacket, one pair of socks, and a pair of boots. Like, Patagonia, its terrain is not only difficult, but also its weather is so... it fluctuates within the hour. Like, it can be pouring rain for 4 hours of the day and then snowing for the next 3 days, so.
Right, and that's beautiful, and you want to make sure that you're prepared to...
oh, for sure, and you have to... yeah, you have to take it super seriously, mm-hmm. which is why the checkpoints and rangers are such a big part of the culture out in the park as well.
Sure. Last question. What do you think Patagonia represents for Chile and Argentina?
I think it's a really great source of pride. From my small amount of time that I was in Argentina, people were very excited to hear that we were going to be staying in Patagonia for 3 days, but they were like, oh, you should come back and see Pepito Moreno, which is the glacier that is on the Argentinian side. And same with the Chileans, like, that's so amazing, but when you really, like, get beneath that, it's so interesting that most Chileans have never visited Patagonia, and any of them that have... you know, have worked in tourism, have worked in as guides or as porters, or went for school, or have only been to, like, you know, just the beginning, or have they been to Chiloé? And so, like, I think that there's just this huge gap. Like, people are super excited about it, and I do think that it's a really beautiful place, and obviously, like, Chile should be completely and utterly exposing it to people, because it is such an amazing place, but it does seem to be a little infiltrated by tourists as well as former foreign nationals who own majority of the land south of Chiloé.
A famous quote commonly attributed to Pablo is, "He who does not know the Chilean forests does not know the planet." The foresty, natural Patagonia plays into Neruda's story because, as I've mentioned before, our friend Pablo had to flee Chile in the late 40s in fear of retribution against his political opinions, which were at the time misaligned with those in power. His horseback odyssey took him through Patagonia to freedom in Argentina, and it was during this escape that he continued to work on what is arguably his most important work, Canto General. But the only mention he makes of Patagonia in 100 Love Sonnets can be found in the 85th poem, which will now be read for you by my love, my life, Tate Mulligan.
The vague fog flows from the sea towards the streets, like the stream breath of cattle buried in the cold. And long tongues of water gather, covering the month that our lives have been promised would be heavenly. Autumn on the march, whistling honeycomb of leaves. When your standards fly over our towns, crazy women sing goodbye to the rivers. Horses whiny towards Patagonia. On your face is an evening vine, climbing silently, that love lifts up towards the crackling horseshoes of the sky. I bend towards your fire of your nocturnal body, and I love not only your breast, but autumn, too, as it spreads its ultramarine blood through the fog. I think two things stood out. I think the first portion of the sonnet, when it talks about the fog and how it creeps in from the ocean, in Patagonia, that happens pretty much at all parts of the day, which is kind of interesting and unique to that area of the world. I think structurally, the where the commas were and like how the poem needs to be said, how the author wants it to be stated, reminds me a lot of like a poetry teacher I had. And what would happen was the professor would ask a student to read the poem in front of like 100 kids. And one time this kid just kind of dolefully said it and just ran through the poem. And my professor would get up and his voice would be like, crackly and be like, "No, no, no." "Yeah," says Chico. Just made the comparison. He's like, "Are you gonna run through sex like that?"
He did not.
Yes.
Wait, where was this?
This is in Spain. He was like, "You're supposed to engage with the poem, and when there's a comma, you stop. When there's a period, you take in what the author just said." And I'll never forget that the whole class, like, busted out laughing. And this man is, like, world-renowned. He's, like, traveled and taught all over the world. And so it was just so, I guess, inspiring to see, like, a man of such caliber take the poem so seriously and yet not at all. And so I think that when I, like, look at any sonnet now, I always think of Profe Pozuelo. But I just will never forget him being, yeah, like,
Are you just gonna run through it like that?
Enjoy the freaking thing.
I think you would have made him proud.
There's a reason why the outdoor gear brand co-opted the name Patagonia. It's one of the most sought-after nature adventure tourist destinations in the world. The area is about 10% Chile and 90% Argentina, separated by the Andes into East and West territories. The once crucial Strait of Magellan and Cape Horn sit right at the center. It's apparent what belongs to who.
Is it very clearly demarcated between
It's
the
really
two
demarcated, but geographically, La Cordillera, the Andes, mm-hmm. as it is really, really, well, thick, big, tall, etc., it creates a whole different landscape from one side and the other. For example, our Patagonia has a lot of mountains and snow, rivers, a lot of water, while the other side of Patagonia is flat and almost desertic. It's not like a desert. It does not have mountains. It's, well, flat. It's cold also, but it has no much, it doesn't rain a lot there.
Sure.
So just by seeing both sides, you can tell which one is which.
This is Carmen Channing, my professor of Human Rights in Latin America course this semester. She is absolutely brilliant. Viña del Mar native, PUCV alum. Professor Channing is a nerd for history and wrote her master's in historical research thesis on the colonial British discourse surrounding discovery and mythology in Patagonia. Here's what happened. Around 1765, Captain John Byron and his ship, the Wager, wrecked in Patagonia, forcing him and his crew to sit around for a bit. During their time, there were several revolts against the captain. The groups continued to splinter off, which resulted in several different travel narratives coming from both the West and the East. Because they had this unique chance to observe the area and record what they perceived, from indigenous groups to natural resources, this would come to shape the image of Patagonia in Western memory for a long time to come. Before the wreck and far after the wreck, there were strange perceptions of who exactly lived in Patagonia and what they did. Professor Channing reconstructed this history as a continuation of her mentor's work.
I didn't study the shipwreck itself. It's the aftermath of the shipwreck, which are the four sources that we have, the four narratives that we have of the event. Before that, as Western Patagonia, and that means all the coast to the Pacific, was an isolated territory. No one ever visited because it was too hostile in geographic and weather terms. And just few indigenous groups lived there. Indigenous that by the 18th century, who were supposed to belong to the Spanish crown and colonial rule, were completely alone and free. They never spoke Spanish or had this institutional organization, just nomads speaking their own language. And there are many myths and legends involved in this because as the Spaniards could not have access to the territory, whether they tried or they failed, there was no clarity in ethnic terms who these people were, in cultural terms, what do they do, eat, use for clothes or for housing, etc. And because of, and that's until the 18th century, which it's interesting, for 300 years of colonial times, there is no clarity of the ethnic, social, cultural scenario. And when this shipwreck happened, this castaways, it's called, castaways, kept or were there a whole year in interaction directly with the territory, with the humidity, the rain, the cold, the hunger, and in direct contact with these groups. And it's one of those moments that the social conventions reverts. It's not the European colonialist with the Indian, it's the other way around, the Indian controlling the European.
Now, what does it represent symbolically, would you say?
Tourism.
Tourism, right? Same. Like in the past, it was this kind of, I remember the first time you mentioned it in class, you talked about there being like Bigfoot or like Yeti type legends.
See, many.
And so now it's become commercialized.
Extremely, see. Another thing that I study inside this region is, as it is really, really big, I do not concentrate on the Strait of Magellan because that's where the people pass or navigated. I concentrate on that mid-territory between Chiloé, which is populated, and the strait, sort of populated, which is isolated or unpopulated, or at least by Europeans. And that region in the middle between Chiloé and the Strait of Magellan right now, currently, is the most, or is the less populated region inside Chile. There is not, it's not that there is no Chilean presence there, but it's not a concentration or a destiny inside Chileans to go to still. Mm-hmm. And who goes to Patagonia usually is the tourist or Chileans that are on tourism. Mm-hmm. So the presence of people there rotates or changes. It's not permanent. And who is there permanent are just very few people.
Do you think that impermanence is unhealthy, or do you think it actually is sustainable and it's good for the area?
I think it's good for the area. If companies and industries and everything moved there, it would destroy that thing that it has. It's not just about the landscape, which is overwhelming, but the connection of the people with their territory. The reason why Australes, as we call them, or Patagonians, engage so much with their territories because they're just them with their land, and that's it. So it's a benefit. On the other side, they do not have access to basic services. Meaning, just in Chiloé, which is not that south compared to other regions, in the island itself, there are no real hospitals or clinics. You do not have a university, for example, there. And of course, that undermines the development of people. And also that creates the idea that they are not part of Chile. They are isolated and they relate to the south and whatever that idea of the South means, not with the concept and construction of the Chilean country. Also, or besides that postcard idea and touristic destiny, I think it has to do with border issues. If you ask Chileans about Patagonia, the most probable answers will be like, it's gorgeous, it's the most wonderful thing. Associated to holidays, little things, sports maybe, but also a conflict with Argentina. And there was a moment in Chilean history that we were fighting for a bigger piece of Patagonia, and the president of Chile negotiated, and the general memory we have about that episode is that Chile gave Patagonia away, that it was a gift for Argentinians. That's also another symbol or national symbol regarding this territory.
So would you recommend for people to visit? And what would you...
See.
Why and where should they go so that they're getting the complete story?
I hate myself.
It's just...
I research about Patagonia, but I've never been in
Patagonia. You've never been?
No, but this summer I'm going. I've been in Chiloé a couple of times. And I feel like looking from Chiloé to the south, I always think that's my north. That's what I should be going to. And I would recommend.
Hearing from Professor Channing makes me feel a bit wistful. Watching Maman's episode of Chef's Table now evokes strange feelings within me. It's a rush to see him bust open lamb chops, pour galloping copas of wine, use manjar, a dulce de leche like spread I never knew of before I came here. But at the same time, the episode is impossibly chic and totally inaccessible. It only makes me more and more curious about the other stories of Patagonia. Historical shipwrecks and encounters like that of Captain Byron, the exhausted tourism guides of today, the adventurous backpackers, the tenacious locals, the displaced indigenous. This will be one of my biggest regrets, I think, not traveling further south than Chillán. Patagonia is a symbol for some mixture of past and present, private and public, wildly natural and carefully staged. Everyone wants to go. Everyone has heard of it. And thinking about it in this way got me a little curious about the other symbols of Chilean life, the kinds of big, impossible to ignore, in-your-face stuff that permeates urban and rural experiences in this country. I asked my girlfriends during a dinner we shared recently, and the same ideas kept cropping up. We talked about super ochos, and bread, and Cristal beer, wine, pisco, things I mentioned in the previous episode. We considered the street vendors, the growing Haitian immigrant minority. We got on a long tangent about street dogs and street performers. We marveled at the incredibly powerful, student-led activist movement in the country, which all but takes over the streets on national holidays. We discuss leftovers from the dictatorship, like the strong police presence everywhere, and the route numbers that Chileans are required to give when making most purchases, leaving them easy to track. Toss Patagonia in the mix, and you have a strange image of that which we've been allowed to access thus far in our Chilean semester. It's incomplete, to be sure, but we're fortunate to have it, and like Captain Byron, we are forever changed because of it. Earlier we heard from Tate, who lived and studied in Argentina. Another friend of mine, Dylan, also spent last semester in Buenos Aires, and we had a really interesting conversation before I left about the politics of Argentina and how that intersects with Chile, especially in this place of close proximity between the two, Patagonia. Afterwards, we will hear her read in Spanish an extra bonus poem from Pablo about the nature of these two countries, and that will end my fourth episode. Feels so good to be saying that.
Oh, you know what? When I was abroad, this Mapuche activist disappeared, and the Mapuches are an indigenous community in Patagonia, I'm sure you know. Yep, and his name was Santiago Maldonado, and he was, I think he was from Buenos Aires, actually, but so he was, like, and a lot of porteños, the people who live in Buenos Aires, kind of consider themselves white, which is a history of European immigration, and just, like Argentina was poised to be the next United States in the early, like, 1900s-ish. They were the seventh largest economy in the world, and then that for a couple of reasons that, you know, fell off. And so they also had very similar ideas and beliefs about indigenous people, kind of that Argentina just doesn't have an indigenous population, which is not true at all. But a lot of, at least older porteños, would probably still believe that. So it was really significant that this activist who, you know, disappeared in a border skirmish, and then his body was found the day before the elections, and so a lot of people thought that was border control. A lot of people thought it might be like the critics of the Mapuches would probably be like, oh well, they did it to him, and then they're using it as a political tool. But like, I mean, the theme of disappearances, and I'm sure you'll probably see this in Chile, is still so relevant, because I don't know, there's just a bunch of instances in left and right administrations where important people, like in the trial against the dictators or people in the dictatorship, there was a bombing of a Jewish center, and a judge that was about to, like, I don't know, figure it out pretty much what happened, was shot in his apartment the day before. Like, there's a lot of, one of my Argentine professors was like, there's just this feeling of, where is the justice? And with the Santiago thing, they're like, don't really know what happened, and they don't know what happened with the Amia bombing. They don't know what happened with some people who disappeared during trials and things like that. So there's just like this whole sense of, where is the justice still?
El camino mojado por el agua de agosto brilla como si fuera cortado en plena luna, en plena claridad de la manzana, en mitad de la fruta del otoño. Neblina, espacio o cielo, la vaga red del día crece con fríos sueños, sonidos y pescados. El vapor de las islas combate la comarca. Palpita el mar sobre la luz de Chile. Todo se reconcentra como el metal se esconden las hojas. El invierno enmascara su estripe y solo ciegos somos, sin cesar, solamente. Solamente sujetos al cauce sigiloso del movimiento. Adiós, del viaje, del camino. Adiós. Caen las lágrimas de la naturaleza.
So good.
Thank you.
So good.